We literally had investors turn around to us and go, it's really good what you've done here, but we've invested in this space for the last 15 years and we've been waiting for something like this. And it went from raising 600K to raising 2.6 million in the guts of about 4 weeks.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, it's welcome back to the pod to Luke Mackey. He is the co-founder of Kota. Today, he's going to tell me how he raised 7.6 million euro for his latest venture. Here's my chat with Luke.
Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish businesses who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to become more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the bio below. Okay, you know me. You know I'm massively into my health, fitness, and training. But there's one thing I haven't spoken about before, and that is a product I take every single day. It's a product called Resilience, and it's made by an Irish company called Ethos. What's kind of funny is that every single entrepreneur I meet, that is the one characteristic they have, incredible resilience. So I like that little play on words. It's a multifunctional supplement that supports cognitive function, immunity, which is super important this time of year, energy levels, and it keeps stress at bay. I also love it because it's easy. If you're bringing anything new habit into your life, it has to be easy, and taking Resilience is so simple. I simply mix it in a glass of water every single morning, and I always throw a couple of extra in my gym bag to keep them with me. It's a really tasty blood orange flavor as well. It ticks all the boxes. It has B vitamins, amino acids, vitamin C, and adaptogens like reishi mushroom and ashwagandha. So if you want to try it, I think you should. Go to weareethos.com. And because I like it so much, the guys have given me a discount code. So if you go to weareethos.com, enter Gary Fox at the checkout, you'll get 20% off, which makes taking Resilience about a euro a day, which is an unbelievable price for building some inner resilience. Check out weareethos.com. If you've been listening for a while, you'll know Iconic Offices have been my partner and home in the pod for a long time now. Working and recording in their spaces has helped support the ambitious goals of the pod, and to be honest, really helped it grow. So I partner with them to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, the opportunity to work from Iconic Offices spaces and experience it for yourself. No fees, no catches. Simply visit the Iconic Offices link in the show notes below and enter the code GARY24 and claim your free co-working day pass, or bring the whole team with you and book a day office.
Luke, welcome to the pod.
Good to be back.
The return.
It's a long time since I was on.
It literally is. You were, I think we looked up before downstairs, you were episode, what was it, 45? 2019?
29, I thought. Or was it?
Oh, it was 29.
Yeah.
Episode 29, 2019, September 2019.
Yeah, they were interesting times.
They were interesting times. Now we sit in March 2024. Yeah. Catch me up.
Yeah, I was hoping to do this a little later. I have more to talk about.
We'll get you back on again and again. That's what I actually love, because we're doing the pod 5 years. Actually, this week, you are our 5 year anniversary episode pod. So there we go. And now it's cool because someone asked me that recently. They're like, oh, what's it like now? I'm like, it's great because you're now doing it so long that the stories are now changing and emerging, because 5 years is a long time in anyone's life, but especially in a startup's life, especially in a founder's life. So give people a quick recap on you, say 2019, where were we?
Yeah, I had started my first company. It was a company called Bamboo. And the antithesis for that was I got really impatient. I thought there was a lot of inefficiencies in the restaurant industry, particularly around ordering and queuing and throughput around busy periods. So particularly when it was like QSRs, like quick service restaurants, they basically just did business between like 8 and 9 in the morning, or they did business between 12 and 2 and they were dead, particularly in these like really busy areas. So I was like, okay, there must be a way better way to power these guys or have some infrastructure to enable them to take orders at different times and spread out their throughput. So that sounds like a really technical version of what was an app that allowed you to press a button and have your food or your coffee sitting there waiting for you. Did that for 4 years. I think the first 2 years were really fun and exciting. We raised we were scrapping together, but like for first we were bootstrapped and then we were scrapping together small checks.
When did you start?
2017. Okay. Yeah, 2017. I've literally started right out of college, and I finished college in 2016. And myself and my co-founder, Alan, we just finished college at the same time. We took a desk in a co-working space, try to build an MVP, try to get funded. Everyone said no. Built something and put it in front of people and they used it. And then finally some people believed in us and we got, I think we scrapped together like 50K from Enterprise Ireland or something like that. And then from there we just grew it and slowly took in some money and got to a point where it was doing, it was kind of a lifestyle business, I would say, in Ireland, in multiple different cities. But we just couldn't get it beyond that. We tried to bring it to the UK and we just, it was venture capital, was a difficult one. It was a difficult business. Like looking back now, it probably approached it in multiple ways that were probably different. I would have done them many, very, very differently. I would have taken like an open table model where I was doing the in-house ordering and the pause and stuff like that, and then adding these layers on. But yeah, learned a lot from that. I then, in 2019, I stepped away from the business. I joined a company called Bolt. Bolt was, and it is now probably the largest mobility company in Europe. It's like Uber for Europe. So it was basically taxis, so ride-hailing taxis, e-bikes, e-scooters, car rental, now food delivery. And I wanted something that gave me kind of some of the mirroring of a startup founder. Where he took
talk to me about this, because what was it like as a founder then essentially getting a job?
Yeah, listen, I needed a job. I was pretty broke and I was very burnt out. And I wanted to do something that was still had the same amount of responsibility and pressure that, and then I was able to kind of use my kind of general skills as much as I possibly could. And also just like have to know that I'm getting a paycheck every month. I didn't pay myself in bamboo probably for the last year and a half. So it was, as you can imagine, I wanted something stable. And then, yeah, so we launched them in Ireland through COVID. When I got the job, actually, I got given the contract a week. We got went into lockdown, so I actually had to do some consulting between starting from the lockdowns to actually starting. And when we actually did launch, it was just a balance of basically understanding what the level of lockdowns were. Because if you remember, it was like these level 3 and level 4. And I was like, okay, we definitely can't do anything at level 4. So
Wild. So you started, you wanted something less pressure, and then you started a job right in the week of COVID.
I like that. No, that was interesting. I made it. It was interesting enough as it was, but adding that variable in there of like, if you put a Facebook ad out in level 4, we might get chastised because we're
encouraging people to move around.
And like that was, I remember back then, that was quite a difficult thing to do. But we launched, I think November, December 2020. And was an incredible launch. Like we did, like we signed up like 30% of the drivers in Dublin in their first month. We grew at a really rapid pace.
So your job is essentially to roll them out
there was non-existent. So we had to build a team, build a base of drivers, get the license.
What was it like mentally? What was it like, that challenge? Did you feel energized, or what was it like kind of like switching gears from kind of founder to kind of like, you're essentially, you were a founder of a country here, but what was it like mentally?
It was quite natural, actually. I think the thing that was most frustrating was that, really, when you're a startup, you have your ability. You control when you can launch. Mm. You couldn't control when we launched, and I have some similarities to this business as well, the new business. But not only do we have to get licenses, but we were really held back by the lockdowns. So we'd be watching all the government reports and all these little press conferences of all the different lockdowns, and like watching the COVID rates rise, and that would dictate if we could actually launch this business or not. So once we actually we were able to do that, and actually we were able to kind of just get some users on the platform and grow, that was where the fun started. So there was a good year and a bit of just growth and just like trying different things, experimenting and testing out new initiatives, and trying to do it in a way that was quite frugal, because like the culture of the company is like it's kind of like Ryanair, actually. It's be as frugal as you possibly can and bring cost base down so you can charge less. And I took a lot from that, and thankfully I was coming from a startup already where we didn't have much money at all, so I was able to, I was already quite scrutinistic of what we were doing when it comes to costs.
And like, what was the kind of key learnings then during that time?
That business? I think it's just a lot of operational pieces, a lot of hard skills that you take from the people you're working with. They were 3,000 people, I think, at the time. They had raised like up until that point, I think they raised a good chunk of cash, but it really COVID was where they proved that they were not going anywhere. So they went and did a huge round from Sequoia. And it just showed like the level of operators you have in those businesses and just what can be done with not a shoestring, but a very, with a lot of focus, some really, really good high quality people. And I suppose just one narrow go to market motion, which was we want to be cheaper than everyone else. And we're going to have a better service than everyone else. And that's all that matters. And that was just do it at the lowest cost possible.
So relentless single focus.
Yeah. Well, that was one part. There's multiple things around, but yeah, definitely. And then you're just working with some really, really good operators, whether it's from product or whether it was from on people on the ground or whether it was from just the regulatory and the licensing people. It was just really, really high.
What was it like trying a new industry?
I liked that industry already, and it was a marketplace. So I was coming from a marketplace already.
Okay, I gotcha.
And I like marketplaces, and I was always intrigued by that kind of ride-hailing space. The Uber wars, the Uber and Lyft wars were always quite interesting. And I thought that time had kind of passed because that was a hype market probably like from 5, 6, 7 years before then. But to go and bring that to a new country, to my country, I suppose, where there was a monopoly, there was one ride-hailing provider, and if you, for some reason, just couldn't use that app, you were pretty much screwed. So adding competition and trying to put pressure on more better infrastructure was something that I found like personally quite exhilarating and interesting. And I think we did leave with a bit of a change. So there's three providers now in the market, except one, and rather than one. And there was a huge drive towards more sustainable products or more sustainable services like e-bikes and e-scooters. And like e-scooters are not available now, but like say e-bikes, that when Bolt was started, that wasn't the case. Now there's a fair few of those bikes around.
Talk to me about that kind of micro-mobility space, because it's something that never really makes sense to me.
And it doesn't really.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's okay. Because I just look at them all the time. I'm like, how does that make money?
It's really down. And I think this is the good thing about Bolt was that like everything was so low. They weren't throwing cash at things that were unnecessary, or they weren't overspending like a lot of the players in the market, which you've now probably seen. And also they had a model which was, it was kind of like an ecosystem within their product whereby they own the scooters, they own the bikes, and they have this taxi industry, this ride-hailing industry, and they all kind of feed off each other. So like the bikes and the scooters, they can be profitable and they can make money, and they do, but they also feed as a marketing tool for the ride-hailing, which is probably the most profitable part of the business.
Gotcha.
So that when it's in that model, it's quite lucrative. When it's standalone, I don't think it can be super lucrative, but companies like Lime have shown that it can be, now they've yet to go public. But you've seen companies like Bird and what happened there, but yeah. I think that was a mix of culture and valuations and venture capital getting ahead of itself and being the first player in that space. I think those other players who have been far more, resilient and brutal in their fundamentals to make sure that they actually can last longer.
Well, it makes sense when you say it like that. You know, it's kind of like part of a longer journey. When you can explain it like that, going, you know, you could get a bike to here and then a taxi to here, and then
it was like that last mile piece. Like where we were playing, it was put these bikes or scooters near your DART stations and your bus stations, and you can subsidize what the government should be providing in terms of last mile solutions. People aren't walking home and for 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers, they can actually just jump on a scooter and bring it back to their apartment complex where there's like really like a few thousand people living there, and they can go and reuse that. And that was kind of our sell, which is still the case. And, you know, the beauty of it, I was doing that every day with another service provider, and I was like, we need this to be us. So I was living it.
Talk to me about the Irish infrastructure, because today is a perfect example of a Dublin day. It's wet, it's dreary, it's grey. It took me 2 hours 15 minutes to make what should be a 40 minute journey. Talk to me about the Irish infrastructure, what you learned in that time.
I think we're really bad.
Don't hold back. Go on, I can see you thinking about it. Don't hold back.
I think we're just the most unambitious country in the world when it comes to good infrastructure. And not only have we not planned properly and not built properly, we've now been constrained by a huge green agenda, which is probably we're very car driven as a particularly Dublin. Look at 2 hours coming from like Greystones. Like it took me, I drove in this morning. I know I should be in the dark, but I drove in. It took me the goods of 45 minutes, and I left at 7 a.m. So like you're just stuck in traffic the whole way. And that's just the unfortunate reason is that reason we people have to use cars is because there's very few other options. There's one rail that goes from all the way up the coast of Dublin, and that's on an old Victorian train track that has been there for hundreds of years.
It's closed every weekend for repairs. Yeah, it keeps falling into the sea. Like it's comical stuff.
And we've been talking about a match out that's been built 30 years ago, and that's going to cost us €10 billion. Like, so I just feel like we're just a very, not only have we got a culture of incredible incrementalism of slowly picking away at things in order to keep people happy. And I think as a country, like that's the way our politics works. It's like every election cycle
is
like, we'll talk about the things that are interesting and might get more votes. But ultimately that just results in really slow development. And I think for a country that is full of like ambitious people and people who've changed things, we're really bad when it comes to policy and government. I think decisions like that shouldn't be driven by government either. I think they should be driven by people who are leading those. There should be like CEOs of those departments that are running it like actual companies and have their own KPIs. And have
a long-term vision, like a 20-year vision.
Yeah.
Not a 5-year election cycle vision.
Yeah. So basically like we're so dependent on the roads, but our roads are getting just completely destroyed because we're trying to become more green and but it's just inhibiting our ability to move around.
And it's ironic
I'm not an expert on this topic.
No, but it's interesting to chat about someone from the industry, because like when you look at it yourself, just as a consumer and just as a driver, just as a commuter, you kind of look at it and you go, it doesn't make any sense, because this morning, 2 hours, 15 minutes to come 35 kilometers. And yet people are hybrid working. We've more flexibility than we ever have before. But yet there's been no improvements because of a choke point.
Yeah. I started driving. Like I was actually of the opinion of like, just get the Dart, just get the Lewis, put the rally. Have you seen the weather outside? Like we don't live in a country where that is really viable for 9 months of the year, whereby I can cycle more and more. Like I do cycle and I do take public transport, but sometimes you do have to be very reliant on your car. And I've realized that the more that I started to drive, I'm very reliant on my car.
Well, if you'd be there at a specific time for a specific purpose, I wouldn't rely on public transport. If I'm recording a pod or have an important meeting, I'm not leaving that to chance.
It takes a good chunk of the day already.
Yeah. So when you were in Bolt, then what were you thinking? Were you kind of like the start of the game? I'm done. I'm enjoying this like high-flying corporate life. What were you thinking?
Probably for about a year. And then you start to realize that you're working for someone else and you have to, there's a decision-making process and you don't control that. And there's still levels of bureaucracy in any company, but for a GM in a fast growing company, it was still pretty good, and I still had a good amount of autonomy. But I did miss building my own thing, and it was during a time where there was a lot of people going and building things. It was kind of that time to build where
it was a frenzy, wasn't it?
It was a frenzy. It was that like zero era where everyone was just getting funded and there was zero interest rates, which was just manic and made no sense. But I was sitting back here and going, "Fucking hell!" Like. Imagine if
that should be me.
Maybe a little bit, but that wasn't the real reason I started. The reason I started was because yes, I knew I wanted to start something again, and I had that drive to build my own thing, and I knew it wasn't the last thing I ever started. But it was down to the problems that I saw, and one of the problems was obviously what the outcome of what we built, which was Coda, was around like benefits and the getting coverage and getting protection in the hands of employees. I was in Bolt. It was a huge multinational company. We had to put things like health insurance and pensions and life insurance in place, health and pension in particular. And that process for me, as someone who didn't have any of those products previously, I was 25 at the time. I didn't have a pension. I had to go look at it from the side of the employer setting this up for the team, but also the employee enrolling in it. And it was quite archaic. It was super manual. It was really timely. And when you have employees who are waiting on it and you've got people who are asking themselves like, hey, where is this? Why can't I get in the payroll? Then we have this thing. And you're right, like, it's just taking a while. You're kind of looking at the process itself and just thinking, wow, this is somewhat broken. And I kind of just sat on it for a while. It was one of those things I didn't know anything about at the time. And I was someone who, when I had an idea, I liked to visualize it as quickly as I possibly could. So it was during COVID where you basically sat at home and watched Netflix at night. So I'd pull out my Figma, so my design tool, and I just start designing screens of what this kind of perfect experience could look like for the employee if they were enrolling in it, or the experience for the employer. And just noodle on that for a while. And then I started showing it to people who were like other founders and like, hey guys, what are you doing for benefits? Or what's the problem that you guys have when you set up your pension? And they would all say similar things back to me, and they go, slow, I actually don't even know what we have. I think we have something in place. We didn't do it because it's too expensive, or we've got this problem because we got remote first and our employees are spread all over Europe, so we just haven't done it.
It's so interesting, the pension thing, because some of the smartest people I know hate even talking about it or doing it. And some people I know in finance go, yeah, I just don't like my pension. It's wild. It's absolutely wild.
Well, sometimes it's good just to not look at it and just make sure that you're putting the right amount aside.
Sometimes I don't even know.
Yeah.
You don't even know because it's such a ball ache.
Yeah. And that becomes worse and worse when you're a company of, say, for now, a lot of companies are remote. So if you've got employees in more than one country, like the health and pension and life market is exceptionally fragmented, particularly across Europe. So you've got three providers in Ireland. You've got, say, for example, on the health side, you've got Irish Life, VHI, and Laya. In the UK, you've got five or six providers. And you've got, that's like Aviva, Bupa, AXA, and Vitality, and another one as well. And there's no homogeneity, there's no like consistency across borders. So when you're trying to actually do this as a company that's in more than one country, you end up just being like, you either don't do it because of the inertia, or you have to spend a lot of time and money doing it. And that's where you engage brokers, and that's a slow process. Our thesis is that because it's so offline, because it's so fragmented, because it's not digital first, because it's not easy to access, because it doesn't sync with any of your existing HR and finance tools, smaller companies will not do it. Mm-hmm. And therefore there's a lot more smaller companies. And ultimately what happens is the generation of employees just don't get covered. Or they're getting covered with subpar experiences, and we're trying to enhance both. We're trying to increase the access. We're trying to make it more accessible for the team, for the companies and the employees. We're trying to make it more affordable as well at scale, because it should be a really short value chain. It should be cheap to use. It shouldn't be paying consultancy fees to go and get access to these things. And we're trying to obviously make it more global. We're trying to make it like something that you can use across markets.
Okay. Yeah. So you're in Figma, playing around with it at home.
Yeah.
Why?
It was something that just interested me with how bad it was, and also worried me with by how little people cared about it.
Mm. Why do you think that is?
Because it's boring. Yeah. And people were more worried. If I look at my friends and then my generation, my friends were more worried about like saving for a house than they were putting money to their pension. They're approaching their 30s.
What's my biggest pain now at this point?
Yeah.
It baffles me because they're not mutually exclusive. You don't have to do one and not the other. Like you can do multiple things.
Yeah.
Whereas I think people are like, oh, when I have the house, I'll start the pension. But like you can just chip away. Like it's a psychology piece. That's what fascinates me about finance and personal finance in particular. It's mainly a psychology piece.
Yeah, and they, that stems from the top. That stems from the CEOs of those companies. It stems from the HR departments and the finance departments of those companies. So why, like, the first thing they think about when they think about implementing these things is, first they think about cost, they think about administration, and then they think about engagement. For costs, because they're thinking about like how much it costs for a broker, what's the actual outlay of doing, like what's it going to look like on top of payroll. And the traditional way of doing this tends to be quite binary. It's like, we're going to pay for the full plan, you're going to get this much towards your pension, it's going to cost this much to set up, here's the management fees, all of that, and then here's the broker fees. We try to make that a little bit more flexible. So we try to be much more contribution based. So you can put a percentage aside, a nominal value aside towards like your health insurance. So say you can't give €150 a month towards every employee, you can give them €70 or €50. And it's something, it starts them. And that, at your stage of company, that might be the initial starting point. Then when it comes to like the cost piece, like brokers are expensive. They tend to be cost like thousands per year just for set up a scheme, and then they kind of disappear. We're a monthly fee, like you charge a monthly fee and you get access to the product, and we're going to be there, and we're accountable.
Bring me back to when you were just thinking about it though. At what point were you like, oh, I think I want to do this. I think I want to go again.
I was trying to convince myself not to do it, to be honest, because it was so difficult. So I was actually, I built a deck, and I had the designs and the mockups and everything. And I was trying to convince myself, why wouldn't I invest in this? So I it was like a 12 page pitch deck. I did an FAQ and everything to with sightings of reports and market analysis and even quotes from people I'd spoken to really go pick holes in it myself, to a point where I started showing it to people who really knew about the subject matter. And they're just like, you should really do this. And that's where it gave me a bit more confidence. So I was talking to people in insurance, I was talking to people in brokerage who were like, people like you don't really exist in this domain yet, as much as they should. Try it. So what's the worst that can happen?
Break this down for me, because I think this is a fascinating piece between the first time founder, second time founder thing, because you know, this is why serial founders are so backable. Like, how did you approach this differently? You kind of outlined it there, but give me kind of a succinct example of how you approached this startup differently than the first.
Firstly, I had more experience. That helps. I was far more cynical and critical of what I was going after. I didn't want to fail, but I knew anything you do, you have to have an appetite to fail. It had to be really, really large market, really big impact. And it meant that all of those things kind of lined up for me to be like, okay, well, if I didn't do this and someone else, do I think someone else will? And I thought they will. I think there was the trajectory of the market. It was like, I felt like the insurtech space that we're going after was probably like 5 to 10 years behind where the fintech space is now, particularly things like open banking and payments. Like, they're much more evolved than where, like, say, insurance and pensions are. So it was like, okay, if I don't do this, how annoyed will I be? Or if someone else does, but also how annoyed will I be if it just doesn't get done? I can't use it for myself, because I wanted something to solve my own problem, which is always a good place to start.
It's the best. Like, and it's so often overlooked. People go looking for ideas. And I teach a lot of classes around kind of entrepreneurship and idea generation. And people are always like, oh, let's go find some ideas. I'm like, just find problems, find your own problems. Like, because it is the most proven path for entrepreneurs for success.
So it was really like the problem, the market was a big one. And it was a case whereby I also had two of the co-founders who had this same problem, one working in a multinational, one working for themselves. And I thought that was interesting, that it's multifaceted. It's not just these multinationals, it's startups, it's individuals. It's just huge underserved market. And the consistency there, the thing that kept popping up, was just the age. The demographic of worker are far used to a different user experience, and they can really disengage from this other user experience. And that's not going to get better. Like, people aren't going to get more used to using paper. They become more disenfranchised, become disengaged, and their attention span is getting shorter and shorter anyway. So the trajectory of where the solution was going to happen at some point in time. So I think that they gave me a bit more drive to do it. I think that was what kind of drove me to look into it more and then get more feedback. And the feedback cycle we had was pretty intense. So I think we spoke to 60 or 70 heads of people, CEOs, heads of finance.
How did you do that? Because this is a critical step and most people skip this. How did you talk to that many people? And I mean, literally tell me, like, how did you get introduced to them? What was the process like? How did you interview them? What was it?
A lot of the time it was either people in my network that I forgot were in my network that had that HR background or had that kind of opsy financy background. It was just people I was connected with on LinkedIn as well. I just reached out to them.
And what'd you say?
Hey, I'm thinking of building something. Can I get 15 minutes of your time? And I want to just run you by something. And I would explain the problem and they would reiterate that was the problem. I'd ask them how they currently deal with the solution. What are they doing? I would show them a mock-up of what we were doing and I'd get them to scrutinize it. I'd get them to ask questions about it. I would then write down as much as I possibly could from what they were saying. I was probably recording most of those calls. And then I would go back to them after the call and you'd email them and say, hey, you mentioned this, would this solve their problem? Or is this the reason why you're doing this, to try and understand the market a bit more? So I did that for about a year before I took the jump in. And it was a case that we didn't have, myself, my two co-founders, Patrick and Deepak, we didn't have anything. We didn't have any funding. We just had this idea that we thought, you know what, let's just go and do it. It just seems like it's meaningful. It's something we can all get behind. We know it's gonna be exceptionally tough because it's not only is it infrastructure, because we believe that this has to be an infrastructure first problem. This is something we're actually building the kind of the rails for this industry to work, but also it's regulated. So it's a mix of two really difficult things, and then SaaS on top. So the subscription as a service, this really nice kind of B2B and B2C product that the employers and employees engage with. So we jumped in. The guys went off to try and build an MVP in which we had an understanding of what we think we needed to achieve in the first year.
At what point did you decide to do it? Because you did 60 to 70 interviews, critical feedback, critical feedback, critical feedback, tweak, 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 tweak. At what point did you decide to go, right, this is it?
We started answering all of the questions that were around reasons why it would fail. And they all kind of came back to the point where, so we were like, why would this fail? It would fail because of this, but that's, we can solve that. Or like, how can we shift this problem? If this, the first version of this doesn't work, how do we still make it valuable to this other ICP, this other like customer profile that we were going to go after? If it doesn't work for this market, how does it work for another market? We basically kind of shifted around, okay, we don't think it will fail, but it could fail, but if it does, fail on this trajectory, how do we move it over to another one, another one, another one? We saw a ton of application. So we thought it was worth a shot.
How did you find your co-founders?
I'd actually worked with them before. So Patrick was my CTO in my first company, and Deepak was my director of engineering in Bamboo as well. And we just stayed in touch, and we knew we wanted to build something together. We spoke all the time throughout COVID and when we were working in separate companies. And we, so much so, we would actually take days off work and go and workshop this idea in somewhere like Iconic offices and just try and figure out why would it not work, and try bottom it out and try and find the reason why, where all the holes were.
I think that's such a huge lesson though for founders, because so few people spend that time to figure out why it won't work.
Yeah.
They're so emotionally invested in why it will work and why it's the most unique unicorn of an idea ever to come out, and they're so precious about it. It's so refreshing to hear founders, especially so nearly all the serial founders, do this, this process. It's so valuable.
Yeah. So we did that until the point where myself and Deepak were like, we're going to do this. And Patrick was like, oh, it's regulated, I'm not sure if I want to do this. And then he finally was like, you know what, actually, this is, I think he jumped back in trying to set up his pension. He's like, you know what, fuck this, let's just do it.
Yeah.
And in January 2022, we started. We took the Christmas and we decided to jump in. And we had no funding. We just had some savings. We thought we needed about 600K to get us kind of like, I think it was like a year to 16, 18 months. We thought it would give us enough proof points to go and raise a real C round. The guys went off and started building the core tech and started. We'd spoken to insurance companies as well by this time. They were a key part of our kind of battle testing of the idea. And I went off to try to raise some money. I used some of my initial network, some of the people in the secondary network, some people who were connectors. And I was just like, hey, I'd love to chat to you about this thing I'm building. And we'd share the deck, I'd share the FAQ. Thankfully, like I had done all of this work where I was trying to convince myself that I shouldn't do this company. And they were like, hey, this looks really good. Put me down for this amount if you're doing this. And it went from raising 600K to raising 2.6 million in the guts of about 4 weeks in January of 2022. February 2022 is kind of when that time happened. So we went from angels to VCs, and then actually decided we had term sheets from multiple VCs, and we had to decide which we wanted to work with.
How did that feel like, Luke? Because you've had an interesting entrepreneurial career. Like, you've been there and done it. You've seen and tried most things. You've experienced a lot over the kind of like the last 4 or 5 years. Like, how did that feel?
It was a bit of a relief, because it was like, okay, well, other people still believe in this. And it was a case whereby it was quickly shifted from like, oh fuck, okay, wow, like there's life left in this life left in this old horse already, like to
at like 26 or whatever you were at the time,
To okay, the ambition changed. Okay. Where now we can do so much more, and thankfully we did raise that, because we were going after an exceptionally hard problem in a regulated space with legacy providers and legacy infrastructure, sometimes no infrastructure, and you're trying to build all this at the same time. And it was validation from people who knew more about this problem too. We literally had investors turn around to us and go, it's really good what you've done here, but we've invested in this space for the last 15 years and we've been waiting for something like this. So that was, and here's how much we want, here's how convicted we are. Here's our term sheet. Like that was what we were seeing. So we raised money from Northzone Ventures, who were an early investor in the likes of Spotify, Klarna, TrueLayer, Personio, and then also Frontline in Dublin. And then Cocoa as well. So that was our first round. We then went and built for the guts of kind of 8-9 months. We built the core infrastructure. We did our first integrations into health insurers. And we started putting our product live and started getting customers, and customers liked this, which is good. Now we've quickly learned like what we needed to change, what we needed to add on, what parts of the experience. And we also, this was our first real integration with a provider. So it was slower than we are now. Like that real integration probably took us about 3 months. And now we can do integration in a matter of weeks into a health insurer. And from there, we just started adding more products and started seeing other parts of the market. Another part of the market that we saw that was quite large was particularly around the infrastructure piece. And when I say infrastructure, it's kind of like our developer products. So our products that a software engineer or another tech company that talks the employee record can leverage to go and offer these products. So embed health insurance into their experience, or embed a pension product into their experience. And that was getting more and more traction. And we started seeing real use cases of large companies coming to us and go, we want this. Can you build it? Or can we buy you? Or this was already happening really early. And we wanted to move quicker. And we so this is probably March of last year, April of last year, whereby we had the opportunity to do another fundraising round when we didn't need to. but we wanted to pick up the pace more.
Hey, we're just taking a quick break from today's episode to shout out our main sponsor. If you've been inspired listening to this amazing business person and either want to start your own business or supercharge an existing one, then the Local Enterprise Office has something for you. Whether you want to improve your online presence, become more sustainable, get into new markets, or just get that idea off the ground, they have the support for you. For more information, check out Local Enterprise Week or log on to localenterprise.ie and see how they can help your business. Now, back to the episode.
How did that come about?
We had customers that wanted a product that we didn't have yet, put it that way.
Great.
and that's a pretty good catalyst to go and try and step on the gas more and not shorten your runway and increase the ambition of the company. So we had spoken to a fair few funds we liked. We put it out to about three or four funds to say, hypothetically, if there's a round happening, would you be interested? And thankfully they were. We ran a process. And in a period of time after due diligence and everything, we had a term sheet and with it from a fund that we really liked, that we've been working with for a while or speaking to for a while and getting to know each other for a while and understanding how they think about the industry and how they think about us. And that was EQT Ventures. So they are a venture arm of EQT Group, which is like a $100 billion private equity firm that have a venture arm that have invested in companies like Nothing, for example, the Nothing Phone, and a fair few others, but they're kind of new, they're newer to the venture game, but they're just exceptional. And they led our seed. So we did a $5 million seed last year. So we've now raised 7.6 in total. We've built a team to 22 people. They're in seven countries. We've onboarded the guts of hundreds of companies at this point. And we're now switching on more markets. So we're trying to do 12 markets this year, 12 local markets. We're already in three in the UK and Ireland and a few others. So we're going to switch on the likes of Spain, Portugal, France, Italy, Netherlands, a fair few others, some out of Europe ones. And it's ultimately just kind of like the optionality is a huge part of what we do. So local optionality with core providers being available through our product instantly, being able to price, to quote, to enroll, to do this all out of the box in a self-serve way is really important for us this year. Mm. And we've been able to serve companies of anything from like 20 people to 300, 400, 500 people. And they love us. Like, we've never lost a customer yet.
That's whirlwind, isn't it? Like, the last 2 years have just been manic for you.
Yeah. I think pace is important. That's another thing as well. Like, I think there's a fair few learnings from what matters most when you're building a startup. There's probably four things that matter. I would say, I think people, obviously the people you're bringing on board is super important. So like recruitment has, we spend so much time hiring people. There's roles that we spent 9 months looking for people for. And we just raise scrutinous. We just scrutinize who we bring on board a lot, because we know we've seen so many different profiles of people now. I think the most important thing is obviously as a founder, it's kind of painting the vision of the company and then making sure that you've done it in a way that motivates and inspires other people. But the people you want to bring in, they have to be obviously have that balance of intelligence and that skill set, but also they have to have like an innate drive to work in a startup of our stage, work of a company of our stage.
What are you looking for?
You want someone who obviously can do the job or has a very high growth trajectory. Like their ceiling is, you look at them and you just don't know where their ceiling is, which is like, okay, like they can be whoever, whatever they want to be. Particularly at the stage we're at, particularly for the roles we're hiring at, they can be whatever they want to be, but they have to have something that's inside them that is driving them towards it, whether they're trying to prove something to someone else or to themselves, or they're trying to like take a certain thing and validate themselves in a certain way. And if you can kind of weaponize them and bring them in and do some great work with you for a period of time, that's really, really useful in a startup. But now you have to, as the founder, you have to be able to coach that and be able to know what makes people tick and understand people and be able to drive that out of people. So that's, people's a big one. Ambition is crucial too. Like I think that also feeds into people. Like ambitious people don't want to work for unambitious companies. So if you're building a really ambitious company that has a lot of impact, then that's going to make change and people can be proud of what they're doing. And for us, we have a mission as well, which is like increasing access for these products that aren't pretty inaccessible for a generation. That's something that people can feed off of. And when you have that, it's just people like it's energy and it's momentum that people can drive off of. And the other one is speed. I think, as I mentioned, like speed is momentum. I think I've seen companies that have died because they just lose momentum. I founded one. And you have to, when you have those, like you have those elements of those variables of like really high quality people that are highly focused, that are moving at pace, that those kind of wins constantly happen, and that just feeds and it's infectious. So speed is really important, and not losing momentum and constantly just like hitting, like chipping away quarter after quarter. And then focus. I think focus is something as well that is just so critical when you're really early stage, because your resources are low. There's only so many things you can do, and you're trying to do everything at a really, really high quality. You're trying to do everything at like 10x better than the alternative. And you can only do that when you've like got people that are so determined and clearly focused on what their task is, or what their owner, what their autonomy is. Mm. So it's a lot of saying no. It's a lot more saying no than saying yes. Yeah.
What do you mean?
Whether it's customers trying to actually build certain things, or people want certain things, you just it's saying no to that. Markets, whether it's what your team want, it's whether it's where you spend your time. Like most of what you do, you spend your time is actually just saying no to multiple things, and not really auditing what you do, and trying to do that at a executive level all the way down to everyone else on the team, and trying to understand where they're spending their time and how efficient they are. It's how you run the company. It's where, like, how many internal meetings are you doing? What's your documentation culture look like? What processes do you have in place so people don't have to pull time from other people? Like, you reaching out to someone on Slack is actually pulling them out of the work that they're meant to be focusing on, and that's how do we make that happen less? It's all of that feeds in together and compounds to kind of create this entity or create this organization that you're just trying to kind of grow over time and scale and do that.
It sounds like you're in an absolute flow. Like just even listening to you here last half an hour, it's really interesting. Like you're in such a flow. How does it feel compared to last time?
Yeah, well, there's a little bit more momentum, I would say. Yeah, a little more clearer on what we want to do. So it's all those things. It's a heightened level of quality and focus on people, ambition, focus, and pace. Mm. I was a first-time founder. I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't have necessarily have a massive amount of confidence in all the decisions I was making. It was just a lot of it was gut. I have a lot more certainty in what we're doing now.
Mm, it sounds like it. That's what's really interesting to listen to. I love frameworks. When you said that four things, I'm like, oh, you're speaking my language here. I love that because you need that direction, that focus. And I'm a huge believer in momentum. Like life is all about momentum because you have seasons in life. You have hard seasons and good seasons. You have summers and winters. I'm a big believer in momentum. How did you get that confidence? Because I'd imagine it's ebbed and flowed over the years as you've had wins and losses. How have you entered this realm or this era of confident Luke? Because, you know, it's like confidence is one of those things, like when you have it, it feels like the best thing in the world. And when you don't, it's the worst thing in the world. So how have you generated that?
It's not necessarily confidence. It's kind of certainty in what you're doing and knowing that what you're capable and what you're not capable of and being very self-aware of those things. I've got a bit of muscle memory. I've done this for the last 9-10 years now. It's kind of comes naturally to me. If I wasn't doing this, I think I'd be pulling my hair and I'd be probably really depressed. Like even as difficult as this is, it's the only thing that makes me feel like I'm doing what it's kind of fulfilling or rewarding. Mm. But it's exceptionally tough. And I kind of, it's being aware that while this is really tough, it's you're kind of built for it in some way, and like kind of realize that I'm pretty well built for this. So that's kind of where that confidence or certainty comes from. I was like, okay, well, I can't see around corners, but I can understand the different what might be around the corner, the different options that are there, and how I'm going to tackle each of one of those things.
You feel like where you need to be. You feel like you're in the right spot.
Yeah.
How do you balance this with yourself? Like, how do you? Because it sounds incredibly like it sounds like you've had like a relentless schedule for the last like 8-9 years. How do you balance this with looking after yourself?
I was really bad at it, honestly. I think I've gone in the peaks and troughs of it. I used to be somewhat good at gym and kind of trying to fit that into my lifestyle, but ultimately guilt takes over sometimes and you just work from 7 a.m. to 10, 11, 12 a night sometimes, nonstop. And that really just burns you out. And I've realized over time, particularly in the last, say, year and a half, where I've burnt myself out probably, I won't say burnt myself out, but I just overextended and I didn't make enough time for myself that I actually just become an inefficient version of myself, whereby I'm probably giving 50 to 60% of what I should be giving because I'm not doing the healthy things to make sure that I'm getting like 80% of myself at a more consistent level. Then you drop off. If you burn out, you're dead for like a week And
I think it's the biggest nonsense around the whole startup culture is this whole culture of like, man, you know, we're there like 7 to 11 every day. We just grind and hustle. It's short-term thinking. Like it's always definitely a lot of first-time founders do it because they feel that's what they should be doing.
I think that is necessary. I'm sorry. You actually do have to do that. But if you don't listen to your body and know like, all right, you know, I need to get that extra 2 hours of sleep in, or if I don't go to the gym, I need to stay disciplined on that stuff, or I need to go and see my friends, or I need to go and clear my head. Like that stuff's all necessary in that relentless period. Sometimes you do go through those sprints of 2-3 weeks, just really hammer down, and you are just trying to find those hours to try and like take your mind off something or trying to get the sleep in.
So how do you approach it?
It's a mental game and it's a physical game. I think something I've started doing, I've started seeing a therapist, which is pretty helpful. I think founders are probably some of the most mentally all over the place people in the world. We're all kind of weird. So I think go see a therapist. You have a lot of unresolved issues probably. That's quite useful. And then exercise and kind of putting that energy towards something that is more physical and you can use and use towards prolonging your body. I kind of have to do something every day now. So what I've done is I run, I go to the gym, I do sauna. I run with my friend.
Speaking my language.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I'm typical tech bro. Right? Absolute fucking character.
That's true though, man. Like the fundamentals, right? Look after your cardio, look after your strength, and the sauna is just powerful.
And you get addicted to it if you don't do one of those things. For me, I'm getting addicted if I don't do something like that every day, whereby I feel really unproductive, even though I'm working really hard. But then I've let myself off the hook a little bit by going and getting an hour in the gym and thinking that hour could be better used for me in front of the laptop. Actually, no, if I go to the gym at 7 or 8 o'clock and then come back and maybe do a little bit of work before bed, whatever it is, like I do feel like it's more productive, it's more efficient. Stupid things. Like I decided to run a marathon. I don't run. I started running in like November. And
running's the new buzz, man. Running is the new thing. Hybrid athlete.
My friend got me into it and I'm addicted to it now. My friend got me into sauna and I'm addicted to it now. And then I balance that with gym. So I think doing that stuff with other people and being accountable and making it social has been quite helpful for me.
It's huge, man. Yeah. It's massive because, again, this ties into what we're talking about there. As a founder, you can become really antisocial. You become so focused on what you're doing, you lose that connection. And like we're a community species, like we need to be around other people, and you need to be around people that aren't related to what you're doing as well.
I think sometimes I go to this one with like 3 or 4 other founders,
but like they're not in your company though, right?
But it's like-minded people who are also just kind of a bit weird as well. And
but that's different though. If you're going like with your coworkers and stuff, that's you're still working. Whereas if you get out of that kind of like social circle and you're with people you enjoy spending time with, just even like you said there, I'm a big believer in like slowing down to speed up. That hour can speed you up 3x maybe in an hour later, whereby just sitting there grinding away, your brain can't recharge. It can't get back to where you need to be. An 80% Luke is 10 times better than a 5% Luke. Like.
Particularly when you're context switching all the time.
If
you're jumping between different things all the time, you are not in a headspace that is super creative or thinking about things in a way you probably need to think about. So I found exercise particularly and kind of the other kind of outside of work stuff particularly useful. To be able to step away and reset and then come back at ideas or come back at things in a different thought process. You can get stuck in your way sometimes. Yeah. And you get like stuck in the monotony of contracts and one-to-ones and that is an exception. That is an exceptionally creative place to be when you want to talk about product and roadmaps and design.
When's your marathon?
May. Copenhagen.
Oh,
flattest
nice.
Marathon in Europe.
Is it?
Yeah.
I was going to say why. Is that why?
Yeah. And then like there's a few friends that are doing it as well. So we're kind of,
that's cool.
A friend who's an actual runner, a proper runner. He'll smoke me, but I just want to finish.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. I love seeing there's a real swing towards fitness and health among founders as well. I think it's really, really cool to see. Like there's a real trend towards like looking after yourself more, which is huge. Like the sauna's mad. Like the impact the sauna's had on my life is monumental.
It's great for stress.
It's
going from really, really hot to really, really cold and really, really hot to really, really cold. You don't feel those that like, even though I track it on my aura ring, like my level of stress level just goes down and you can kind of control it a lot more. not that I'm exceptionally stressed anyway, but like that's.
But it's wild. And like the impact it has on your long-term health is if the studies are even half true, yeah. It's monumental.
Yeah.
Like in terms of lifespan, health span, your cardiovascular improvement, like it's massive.
Mm. Yeah. And it's something you can go do with your friends. It doesn't involve alcohol. Yeah.
It's huge. Like there's a lot of trends coming. Like I think 35% of people aged 25 don't drink. There's a massive amount of trends coming towards, and that's definitely one of them, the no drinking thing. And especially like if you're looking after your head as well, alcohol is definitely not one of those things. We're a nation of absolute booze hounds, and I think that is changing, thankfully. And it's still the trends of like running, sauna, fitness, looking after yourself. Therapy is another interesting one in terms of like if that was, you know, if you call that like high performance coaching, every founder in Ireland would be queuing up to do it.
Well, I think it is because it actually just tells you what your drivers are. It's like, hey, here's why this matters to you so much. It's like this thing that happened when you were a kid or whatever it is. And you're like, oh, wow, okay, this, you're kind of tying the, kind of connecting all the things of why you behave in certain ways.
Perspective. It's, we talked about perspective earlier, just to sit back and like view yourself from a little bit further back. Whereas like you go to the gym, train your body, and then most people don't do anything to train the mind. When I always rank it as brain, body, business. Yeah. If you're managing from top down, that's where all the flow, we talked about flow earlier, that's where flow comes from. Because if you can just like clear the decks and give yourself a bit of perspective and kind of stand back and go, right, this is why I'm doing those things. Yeah. And we see this all the time with founders, they repeat the same mistakes.
Even things that are like, I don't know why I acted that way. I really regret it. It's like, but that makes sense because of this. Yeah.
And you can kind of understand yourself more. Yeah. So give me like a flash forward, like you've had a manic kind of couple of years. What is the next kind of like 12 months, I guess, is a long time in your world. 12 to 24 months, what does that look like for Yonder and yourself?
We're very much in like a monetization mode, I think a growth mode at the moment. So really beefing up our go-to-market side of the house. And we've got two part of the products. We've got our infrastructure product, which is our developer product, and we've got our B2B product, which is what like HR departments and finance departments use to go enroll their team members. And it's really beefing up both sides of the house. When it comes to generating the product, of course, but also what we're doing around sales and marketing. So you're just going to see a lot more about us. And then a lot more expansion. We figured out like that we've got some elements of product market fit in certain markets, and we're just trying to understand that in other markets. And then it's about investing into those markets and ramping up our customer adoption. And then, like reality is we're just kind of, the way we look at things, the way we run the company now is in a very short-term mindset. With a long term, like reverse engineers back from like 10 years to 5 years to this year to the quarter.
I love that.
And that's really where that's everything we refer to is always on the quarterly basis up to like what we're trying to do this year. And here's how that ties into the vision of what we want to do.
So you've kind of a 10, 3, 1 quarter roadmap.
Yep.
I love that. Yep. That's how I manage my life, weirdly enough. But like, I think you need that, right? Yeah. And it'll change, right? It'll completely change.
It's a $100 billion industry. And we're very, very far away. Maybe in 10 years, we've got a percent of that or a certain percent that you can point at. But we can't think like that right now. We need to think about the problem we're tackling right now and chipping away at that. It's like biting into the elephant or whatever they say.
Mm.
Yeah.
So is that how you manage it? Because that is something a lot of founders struggle with, is that like, it's such a big problem. Where do I start? Or people are trying to start the business. Is that your mindset? You break it down into manageable chunks?
Yeah, there's a strategy there of how it all could work and how it can all scale and how it can all be very defensible. But if you're not executing on it, it's useless.
How has it been kind of like going to 22 people? Because that's a big jump. What's it been like kind of growing that out and scaling? I know you said it's hiring is kind of your number one priority, but what's it like even like growing from the three of you initially with an idea to 22 people? Because it's a very different company.
So far it's fine. I think just a lot of reports. So I've probably got like 7 or 8 direct reports now. But it's like you step away from certain parts of the business or like for example, sales. I would have built the sales function up over time. Done it for the first, say, 50 companies, brought in someone to lead sales, and then step away from that. And there's points in time where I might jump back in and be involved in it in some way or try to support. But I think the key thing is that I've hired people that are way better than me at these things. So it's just about giving them the autonomy and the resources that they need to go and execute on that and build a structure and a process that allows us to kind of make sure that they have everything they need and that they're moving at the right pace and that their priorities are the right priorities. And that certain people are going to be really good at parts of the department, but they may need help in other parts. So we've done things around that as well, like be bringing in a chief of staff to try and like jump in across department and try and make their people more efficient, and be able to jump into, say, parts of the department we don't have anyone, say, for example, legal. So we've people who can, like, we can kind of like, we've generalists there.
The chief of staff role is interesting. I'm seeing that more and more crop up. Yeah. I'm seeing two kind of trends across startups, fractional hires, so fractional CMOs, fractional CFOs, and the chief of staff role. Talk to me about the chief of staff role.
I think for the scale we are and the type of founders we are, it's been quite useful, because I think founders generally are really good at putting like the first 30% of a process in place. But because they're so, not maybe not distractible, but because they're being pulled in so many different directions, the last, say, 70% of that process needs to be implemented and needs to be looked at and needs to be reviewed and needs to be iterated on and needs to be perfected. And it's not really perfected, but it needs to be put in place properly. And this is where things break. If you don't have someone who's taking full autonomy of that and able to put this process in place and hone them and be really organized, you're just going to be constantly falling over yourself and tripping over yourself. You'll go from, like I said, I go from one department to another department to another department, but then look behind me and everything's broken. That can't work. Mm. So having someone who's able to do that, also just taking things off your plate that don't necessarily need to be there. Like sometimes it's HR stuff, sometimes it's finance stuff, sometimes it's legal, sometimes it's like the first review of a contract, or being able to, that stuff becomes really, really, really useful when you have a chief of staff that you give autonomy to and has the ability to see what you see and understand the chessboard and be able to say, well, actually, I think I can, you can put me on this thing. You don't need to be on it. Go get that hour back.
It's almost like scaling the CEO's time. When I see it done really, really well, and I see it done in really great companies, it's almost
done very poorly as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And it depends on the founder, right? Look, self-awareness is a big bit, right?
Yeah.
Knowing what you're good at and knowing what you're not good at. It's a really interesting role. It's definitely something I see growing in the future. Yeah. What else do you, as a founder who's raised significant money, what's been the other unlocks over the last kind of couple of years that you've learned that you didn't know when you were a first-time founder?
I think like learning to step away has been a big one. Like step away from processes and give people just not, like not the word micromanage, but let people make mistakes is one thing that I've had trouble with. There's certain things that you do want to be hands-on on. You want to make sure the quality is to a certain standard, but you're always going to be so emotionally attached to certain things in the business. You're never going to be happy with everything. So there are points where you just have to step back and go, you know what? Like, they are the right person for this role. I've hired them for a reason. They're here for a reason. They've done it before. They know what they're doing. This may not be the thing you want to go and step on and go, oh, I don't like that. Or like, let them go and make their own mistakes and let them go build their own vision for what they want to do. That's something I've been much better at. You don't have to have like your fingerprints on everything.
Mm. Yeah. Again, it's self-awareness, isn't it? Is that not experience? It's really interesting.
That's a road, because they're going to go and they'll surpass what your vision of it was.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating talking to a second time founder. It's such a different chat than first time founders. Like, there's so much knowledge there. And that's why I love doing these podcasts, because you're distilling down years and years of experience into something that, you know, is now available to first-time founders. That's why I think it's so interesting to do these ones. We're going to do our quick fire round now in 1 second. What does, like, for people that are listening and want to kind of learn a bit more, who's your target customer?
Our target customer is anything from like 20 to 1,000 people. If you've got employees who are younger, who maybe aren't as engaged in these benefits as you'd like them to be, if you've got a pretty low activation rate, there's probably a reason behind that. Mm. And the reason is because you hand them a PDF form and ask them to go fill it out, and they don't really know what they're getting access to. We have like an 85% activation rate. We have our NPS is either 9 or 10. So if you've got a company where you're looking to reduce your cost when it comes to benefits, make it more engaging, and also make it more, I suppose, intertwined and synced with your existing finance and HR, which will just kind of work in the background, maybe you want to reach out to us. And then if employees in more than one country, so like we've got health insurance in 30 countries, we've got quite a strong product in the UK, we've got a very strong product in Ireland. So, I think if we look like you've got employees in any of those regions, you should speak to us.
Yeah. Such a cool idea. I love it. It's such a clever idea. You're all the buzz. I said this when we met for coffee, like your name just keeps coming up in so many different conversations. There's something special happening with you in this company. So I'm delighted you came on. I'm going to do a quick fire round.
All right.
What book would you recommend every entrepreneur read?
I think the first time I was on, I mentioned How to Think About Hard Things. That's still, I definitely recommend that, but I would change that now. I'd say Amp It Up by Frank Sleethman. Frank Sleethman's
CEO. I don't think we've had that one before. Amp It Up.
Amp It Up, yeah. It's basically his principles of how you should run a company. He was the CEO of a company called ServiceNow, Data Domain, and more recently Snowflake. He's just retired. But two of those companies are in the top 10, I think top 10 or top 15 SaaS companies on the stock exchange, on the stock market.
Sold. What's going on the Amazon wish list today?
It's basically just about like what I was talking about. It's about increasing pace in companies, increasing focus, urgency, building really, really high performance companies. Yeah.
Beautiful. That's a brand new recommendation. What's the biggest thing you've learned about yourself since becoming an entrepreneur?
I can take a lot of punches probably. I can take a lot of things without it breaking you, which is a really good thing for a founder. Yeah, whether it's work or personal, like I've seen a lot in probably a short period of time. I think that just is pretty good for an entrepreneur to be able to be quite resilient and relentless. I just kind of realize it about myself. That's one thing that I think is, if I can point to that, like there's a lot of other things that I like about myself and I don't like about myself, but that's the one that I think is, it's helpful.
You've definitely put the reps in. There's no doubt
about
that.
Some reps are there, yeah.
What valuable business is no one building?
I tweeted this a while ago, just purely because it came up and it comes up all the time for me. It was as a use case and I have no interest in building it, but it's, I feel like the world, the bookings.com, the Skyscanners, they're almost like analog now because they're very, it's just a transactional marketplace. You go and you find something. I think AI can be applied to that so easily. I think if you were to say, I want to go to a hot country on these dates, or I want to be on a 3-hour flight, I want anyone to pay this amount of money. And
I thought about this
surface me, like, or even like that's like personal, but then there's on business as well. It's like, I'm going to Munich. I want a hotel that costs this much. That's this close to the city. And you have everything from your entire itinerary is kind of built, and you just have to hopefully there's a checkout point to that as well, or I have to go at least it points you to the points of those checkouts, kind of like a Skyscanner or a booking. But that would just be really useful, I think, just to take a lot of decision making. Because how much time are you kind of flicking around between
hotels
and flights and stuff like that? Like,
yeah. And it's the paradox of choice.
Yeah.
Too much choice is a killer. Yeah. I think there's going to be monstrous big businesses built out of curation over the next 5 to 10 years. Yeah, AI will play a part, but I think curation will be a big part of it. Sometimes you're like, I want to go away for 5 days. I just want it to be sunny for me, my partner, my baby. That's it. Hit me.
Yeah.
And here's my budget.
I'll give you ideas because you probably think of the same places. It. You're always going to Marbella.
what a first world problem to have, right? I do love it. What would you do today if I give you 10 million? You can't invest in your own company.
Probably just invest in Irish startups for the next 5 years. Yeah.
Just looking for punishment. What's something in your daily routine you wish you'd started sooner?
Sauna.
I'm going to give you 1 million. You can invest it in one person or company. Who is it?
A friend of mine, Will O'Brien. He started a company called Ulysses.
This guy's popping up everywhere. He keeps popping up on my Twitter and LinkedIn.
He's great.
What's his story?
He's just a good thinker, curious dude.
He sounds like an interesting guy. I must meet him, actually.
That or just buying secondary SpaceX shares. Yeah.
I think the secondary share market is very interesting. I think someone should do something there. If you start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
No, I just build Coda, to be honest. Yeah, I have no other interest in building anything else.
That's fair enough. What do you believe that other people will find strange or strongly disagree with?
See, I'm not much of a contrarian. I think like in some things you are like, and I get uncomfortable talking about things that I don't necessarily understand. I don't think that's just like, there's like the cliche of good things come to those who wait. I disagree with that completely. Maybe that. Yeah. Yeah. I think you have to like, if anything, I've been brutally impatient and calculated in my impatience. And, if I wasn't, I wouldn't be, I don't think I've done much from a successful perspective, but I wouldn't be where I am if I wasn't exceptionally like driven to try and tick certain boxes and drive my own path, be in control of my destiny.
Controlled impatience. What's one thing in your personal life you spend money on that brings you happiness?
Am I allowed to say sauna?
Sure, double sauna.
Maybe. Honestly, don't spend money on things other than coffee, a bit of travel, clothes and health stuff probably at the moment.
Perfect. Yeah. What's your one final piece of advice to every entrepreneur listening?
Get comfortable being uncomfortable is the one I always say. If you can be able to take the punches, it's really half the battle. Yeah.
Luke Mackey, that was an absolute privilege. Where can people learn more about you and your company?
Coda.io. Yeah, that's the website. And then, or on Twitter. My Twitter is Luke_Mackey.
Perfect. Luke.
Cool.
Thank you so much. We'll see you again in a couple of years.
Sure. That's good.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.